Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In 2016, Michael Tubbs won the mayor's race in Stockton, California. He beat the incumbent with an astonishing 70% of the vote. Tubbs was 26 years old, one of the youngest mayors ever in the United States. He was also Stockton's first black mayor. Overnight, Michael Tubbs became a national political star. 4 years later, though, he lost his bid for re-election by 13 points. So a rise and a seeming fall, an alluringly simple narrative. But the full picture is much more complex, and Tubbs tells his story in his new memoir, The Deeper the Roots, a memoir of hope and home. And he joins us now. Michael Tubbs, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I would love to actually start before the time that you became mayor. Back in 2010, Halloween 2010, where were you?
Halloween 2010, I was an intern in the White House in Valerie Jarrett's office focused on mayors and councils. So I was up early writing news clips, getting sodas, taking notes in meetings with mayors and elected officials throughout the country.
And you were an intern, you said, because you were also a college student at the time.
Yeah, I was interning.
Yeah. And you were a student at Stanford University.
I was also a student at Stanford, yes.
And you got a phone call.
Yeah, I remember being in the sort of doing the press clippings and news clip and seeing a call from my mom. But my mom just had such deep respect for President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama that she would never disturb me when she knew I was at work. So when she called me, I knew that it had to be something pretty serious. And I answered, and I could hear, like, muffled cries. And she said, just call me back after work. But, of course, you hear your mom crying. You're like, no, tell me what happened. So then she tells me how my cousin, Donnell James II, had been murdered in Stockton at a house party. And it was sort of that pain, that anger, that hurt, that sense of loss that really became a launching point for what was the last decade of life.
Right. Can you just tell me a little bit more, though? I mean, your cousin was a victim of gun violence, right?
Yeah, he was shot at a house party. He was a victim of gun violence.
And so when you first heard that, in the first moments or the first day that you heard that, you call it a launching point now, but you made a really, really big decision. Can you tell us a little bit about what your first reaction was and the decision that you made?
Yeah, my first reaction was just anger, like real anger, deep sadness. I went back home, had to speak at his funeral, which was really tough. And then I thought about what was the lesson in all this, or how could I channel this rage so it doesn't become all consuming? How do I put like pain, purpose to this pain? And that's when I decided a year later to actually run for city council in an attempt to work out survivor's guilt, work out this anger, and to really just normalize the conversation that it's not natural that the leading cause of death for Black and Latino young men, not just in Stockton, but in this country, is homicides, is gun violence, and how that's actually abhorrent, it's morally reprehensible, and that we all should feel some type of way about it.
And what had been your life plan before that moment on Halloween 2010?
My life plan definitely wasn't to go back to Stockton. I was always been interested in like the policy space for sure, but I had spent before the White House, I spent the summer at Google and really enjoyed it. So I thought I would get like a fellowship and do some consulting or work at Google or all the prestigious things you do after you graduate from college and figure it out. So I had no clear sort of plan, but I just knew for 100% certainty that Stockton was not part of that plan.
Well, Stockton, California is what, roughly an hour and a half away from Palo Alto, where Stanford University is, where you were a student. sort of an hour and a half inland, right? I mean, how different was the life that you were living as a Stanford student from the life that you were living growing up in Stockton?
Stanford was just a completely different world. It was a world of immense resources where scarcity was never part of the conversation, where the answer was always yes. Yes, and how else can we help? It was a place where just imagination and sort of thinking about the future and having real agency, really feeling as if you could create the future, that you didn't have to wait for things to happen, that you could be catalytic and make things happen. It was a very safe place. There was practically no crime. It was very clean. And everything was taken care of. You didn't have to worry about where you were going to eat. You didn't have to worry about anything because all the basics were taken care of. So all you had to do was focus on your studies and focus on the life of mine. And I really enjoyed it.
And so that, and all of those things you're saying you didn't have when you were growing up in the implications you didn't have those things growing up in Stockton.
Yeah. And I think not just in my case, Stockton, but most cities, or at least parts of most cities in this country, have pockets, or not even pockets, have the majority of the population that doesn't live in a place where it's guaranteed that all the basic necessities are met, where there's not crime, clean, where your only job is to think and create. It's such a luxury and a privilege. It was definitely different from sort of not just my experience, but the experience of many of my former constituents in Stockton.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So this very, like, this tragedy, it's the tragedy of your cousin's death that as you've told us, that takes you back to Stockton. There are a lot of different things that you could have done, but you ran for a city council first, right?
Yeah, I ran for a city council seat as a 21-year-old college student.
And tell me, what was that like?
That was the most ridiculously exhausting thing ever. Well, I mean, probably second to having kids, but it was just, I was still a student. I was getting my master's and my bachelor's at the same time. So I was taking 22, 23 units. I was commuting back and forth. I was running a campaign. I was learning how to campaign. I never campaigned before. I was writing papers at night, getting chased by dogs during the day. But it was also just, I learned so much about like my city, mm-hmm. and about people. I learned so much about myself. And I learned so much about what's possible in politics. I learned about sort of how to galvanize folks, how to build coalitions. And it was just an incredible learning experience. But I don't think I would ever have the energy to do something like that again, in terms of, again, 23 units, commuting back and forth, running a campaign, starting out the campaign with zero name recognition, $0, and building it into sort of the winning campaign. It just took a lot.
Mr. Tubbs, if I may, I'm feeling tired just listening to you describe that. It's kind of incredible here, but I would love to hear a little bit more about what you learned about Stockton, right? Because then you took that and turned it into your first mayoral campaign, which was hugely successful. So what did you learn about Stockton in that initial foray into local politics?
I learned that people were really hungry for leadership, that people really were looking for leadership, a vision, something to be excited about again. I learned that and it sounds so cliche, but I just learned the commonalities of folks' fears and experiences, no matter where they lived in Stockton, the things they cared about, notably their children. I learned that there was a great concern for the future, that they were worried that Stockton wasn't a place that their kids, no matter where they lived, could do well or come back to after they graduate from school. And I also learned that I was really able to transcend different boundaries, and to build together a coalition of business interests and grassroots activists and folks living in poverty and folks living in affluence, and that mirrored the city in terms of its diversity. Mm-hmm. So all those things were helpful, as I governed as a council member, and then I learned that I could be effective, that I could get 4 votes, that I knew how to operate, and for all the imperfections of the system, I at least knew how to make it work for my constituents yeah. while we fix all the bigger things that were broken. Yeah. And I learned that I actually liked it. Like I was maladjusted enough that it was kind of fun. The conflict, the meetings, the conversations, the relationship building. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Now, if I remember correctly, and do correct me if I'm wrong, but it was at this time that you started also garnering, or let me just put it this way, some national figures were paying close attention to you. You already had, some familiarity with some folks in the White House, but is it for your after your city council run that Oprah, what, she donated money to your mayoral race? Correct me here.
No, she donated money. She's one of my first donors to my city council race.
Your city council race. Okay, yeah.
My city council primary, like before anything. We met at a luncheon at Stanford, and she was like, how can I help you run for city council? And she sent a check 3 weeks later. So she was one of my first donors. And that created a lot of momentum and a lot of interest, a lot of buzz. So then a documentary was made about my city council campaign called True Son, which kind of cataloged running for office as a 21-year-old and how do you do that? Lessons learned, et cetera. And sort of came in as a city council person with kind of unrealistic expectations because of the documentary, because of sort of Oprah's investment. And so came in not with the same level of scrutiny or same level of a profile as mayor, but definitely with more than your average council person from Stockton, for sure.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, when Oprah waves what feels like her magic wand, I can understand why people put a lot of hope into the possibilities that you brought. So we're going to talk about how that all unfolded in your mayoral campaign a few years later. My guest today is Michael Tubbs. He is the former mayor of Stockton, California. He's out with a terrific new memoir. It's called The Deeper the Roots, a memoir of hope and home. And we'll have more in just a moment. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're speaking with Michael Tubbs. He's the former mayor of Stockton, California. He's got an incredible life story, and he tells it in his new memoir. It's called The Deeper the Roots, a memoir of hope and home. And we have an excerpt of it, by the way, at onpointradio.org. So how did you make the decision, Michael, to move from what you were capable of doing on the city council to running for mayor of Stockton?
My 4 years of serving on city council was during a really interesting time in the city's history as we were rebounding from bankruptcy. And we also had a mayor who I just did not get along with. It was like oil and water. And we were just polar opposites. I just did not see eye to eye on any issues. There was no love lost. And we accomplished a lot in spite of his leadership. But after 4 years, I had actually decided to run for county supervisor. and to do more work on social services and thinking about how to make the social service system actually work for my neighborhood, my council district, which was the same as the supervisorial district. But as the race for mayor began to start it, unlikely people would come up to me and say, I want you to think about running for mayor. The head of the local business council, a group of mostly older, mostly conservative, but mostly white folks, pulled me aside and said, I can't believe you're not running for mayor. We need you to be mayor. The police chief, he was like, I would appreciate if you thought about running for mayor. And when I realized that, oh my gosh, if the head of the business interests and the police chief are like, we want this guy, knowing what I stand for, knowing how equity is a necessity for me. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a surprise. I said, if they're on board, then there's actually something here. And I had really wrestled with the decision to not run for mayor because I thought there's a lot I could do just from the position with the pulpit, set priorities, bring resources, change the perception of the city. And I decided to switch course and decide to run for mayor.
And when you did, we talked about how Oprah had supported your city council run a couple of years earlier. And just to remind folks, your mayoral run was in 2016, right? So that was an extremely consequential election everywhere in the United States. but you also, you got the support of the brightest lights on the progressive left, right? President Obama endorsed you. You had connections with representatives Ocasio-Cortez and Ilhan Omar. And so I'm wondering, that all definitely helped in your 2016 landslide win, right? I mean, like 70% of the vote you won, beating the incumbent. So no small feat. Go ahead.
I was going to say, well, AOC and Rep Omar, they weren't elected to 2018. Right. So I was actually before them doing these things. So I met them. We've been friends and they've been helpful since their election. But in 2016, they had no idea. It was before the squad. It was before anything of that sort.
Yeah, I just want to say I appreciate the correction there. I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself here because my mind had jumped to sort of some of the programs that you wanted to roll out in Stockton during your mayor your time as mayor. So I definitely always appreciate the correction there. So actually, let's just use that as a way to turn to that. Once you won the race, what were some of the changes, like the specific changes that you wanted to bring to Stockton?
I really want to deal with the issue. I really wanted to bring real economic development, but my thesis was to build new buildings and to have nice things. We have to really invest in all of our people. We have to shore up the fundamentals of our economy, which are the people. So we have to invest in people. We have to have opportunities for our young people to achieve higher education. We have to work strategically with the state to get a public institution in Stockton, because we're the largest city in California without one. We can't just put lipstick on a pig, but we have to actually deal with structural issues. We have to reverse legacies of redlining and environmental racism. We have to really prove that the city works for everyone. We have to be a safer city. We have to reduce shooting and homicides. We have to be an affordable city for people who live in Stockton. It's a very ambitious agenda, but it were all the things that were necessary. And all the things that everyone deserves and that some people get to live, get to have in their lived experience in communities. And I just want that same opportunity afforded to everyone.
Mm-hmm. And how many of those ideas and programs do you think were successful? Because you're talking about big systemic change, which, as we all know, it just can't happen overnight. So what specifically did you do to advance the goals, your goals?
Yeah, so I on the violence front, in addition to the Office of Violence Prevention I helped create when I was a council member, I added in another community intervention called Advanced Peace to really target those who are carrying guns in our community and not just throwing them in jail. Because we had tried that for 100 years, it just didn't make us safer. But really providing these men with opportunity and letting them know that they were part of our recovery. that Stockton can only reach its potential if they reach their potential, and being really intentional about the trauma-informed care, the case management, and real opportunity we're giving them. Because again, the jails, the police department, the prosecution wasn't going anywhere, but they were just necessary but not sufficient for safety. So we did that program, and we reduced homicides. 2018, 2019 were the only 2 years in this entire millennium. And 2000 has had back-to-back years with less than 40 homicides, and that's in context of a population increase. So per capita, two of the safest years in our city's history. And even in 2020, there was a rise, but that rise was based off kind of domestic incidents related to COVID-19 or stuff in the homeless encampments and drug trafficking going on there. But it wasn't like the group gang homicides that had plagued our city for a generation.
Yeah.
On the poverty piece, we piloted the first basic income program a city has done in this country. And proved before COVID-19, before my good friend Andrew Yang's presidential campaign, that you can trust people with money, that you can provide people economic floor. And I think the success of that program is illustrated in the fact that there's now 60 mayors who are part of Mayors for Guaranteed Income. When it started with one mayor from Stockton. Mm-hmm. And we have a child tax credit, which is now a guaranteed income for families with children. And then on the education piece, we were able to get the state legislature to to put in money to begin thinking about planning for a higher institution of higher learning in Stockton. But also I created a program called Stockton Scholars, where for the next decade, every single kid who graduates from our largest school district is guaranteed a scholarship to a four-year school, two-year school, or trade school. And then also started my last month as mayor, childhood savings accounts. So that all the 3 to 4 year olds in the most poverty stricken parts of the city are given a childhood savings account that's going to compound interest and grow. So by the time they graduate from high school, that plus the Stockton Scholars Grant will give them real opportunity to pursue higher education, to break cycles of intergenerational poverty.
So, you know, in a minute or in a couple of minutes, we're going to talk about why, despite all of those things that you just laid out, you had a really tough battle for re-election and ended up losing that and the lessons learned from that. But I wanted to actually just step back for a moment, if we could. And I'd love you to tell us about the reasons why you personally know how policies from your own life can both – some policies can hurt people, other policies can help people because you lived it, right? I'm thinking about – you know, like some of the policies that helped you succeed when you were growing up in poverty. Like, there was a time in your life where motel room vouchers kept you out of homelessness. Is that right?
Yes. And then I tried in the book, I tried to really illustrate how poverty could be a force for good. I mean, not poverty, policy, excuse me, could be a force for good and for bad. So I remember when my mom and I were homeless for a little bit. We weren't out in the streets because we were able to find vouchers that paid for us to be in a motel room for a month while she kind of got her finances and made enough to put a 3-month down payment down for an apartment for us to rent. Magnet programs in public schools were part of my education experience. After school programs, part of my educational experience. WIC, sort of the support the government gives to mothers with children, from milk and cheese to diapers, was helpful. Head Start, being in a subsidized preschool early, really prepared me to do well in school. Like all these different, I mean, generous financial aid policies and Pell Grants allowed me to go to college. So a lot of these programs I'm passionate about because I know that they work. And also on the flip side, my father has been incarcerated because of draconian tough on crime policies and the 3 strikes law in California. So I know firsthand how policy can also be used to extract from communities, to destroy families, to make it difficult to kind of build wealth and also helps entrench poverty. And that's why I'm just passionate about policy.
Yeah.
I'm passionate about governance because I just know when it works, it can do great things. And when it doesn't work, it causes great harm.
Well, you tell a story in the book about your friend's father guarding your father while they were both incarcerated and sort of like the meaning of that experience. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, I was tutoring a friend of mine on math on the weekends, and his dad would always look at me with a mix of suspicion and intrigue. And I was like, does your dad not like me? What's the problem? And he said, I don't know, man. Let me figure it out. And my friend comes to school the next day and said, you'll never believe this. I was like, what? And he said, there's an inmate, because his dad was a prison guard. So his dad wasn't incarcerated. His dad was a prison guard, a correctional officer. And he said, my dad said there's a guy in his prison named Michael Tubbs. And he was trying to figure out where you related. And I was like, there's no way that's his dad. And I just laughed and said, man, that's weird.
Well, so when you heard him say that his father said there's no way that the man who was incarcerated was your dad, he's saying something there, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, absolutely. I think it was we have these perceptions of people who are incarcerated and their children and their family members, where the idea is that someone whose parent is in jail could be tutoring the prison guard's son is so beyond the realm of possibility for people, because we think that everyone in prison is a terrible person, or that everyone in prison has done terrible things, which sounds true, but it's actually not. There's people in jails and prison because they couldn't pay bail. People who are in jails and prisons because they couldn't afford defense. People in jails and prisons for crimes of survival, in addition to folks who have done serious harm to our communities. But I think it was just, it's like, how could this boy who's getting straight A's, who's so well-mannered, dad be in prison? Like, that's not, there's no way. That's not how a child of an incarcerated parent would act, like, per their kind of schema and worldview.
Yeah. Well, we're talking today with Michael Tubbs. He's the author of the new memoir, The Deeper the Roots, A Memoir of Hope and Home. Well, I want to spend a couple of minutes talking about, one of the programs that you rolled out as mayor. And just to remind folks, Michael Tubbs was elected as the mayor of Stockton, California, when he was just 26 years old. I mean, one of the youngest mayors anywhere in the United States, and Stockton's first black mayor as well. And we talked about your really ambitious agenda and all the new policies and programs that you wanted to and rolled out during your term as mayor. As you know, one of them in particular got a lot of sort of laser-like focus and some criticism as well. You mentioned the basic income program. So you piloted a UBI program again before folks like Andrew Yang started talking about it. But you came under some criticism, though, for it being, it was like a really small pilot, right? It was just 125 people, and that later on, or 120-ish so. And then that later on during your reelection campaign, I mean, there is a vein of thinking that has that a lot of Stockton voters, you know, they didn't necessarily feel the direct effects of that pilot because they weren't part of it. So it's not something that they thought, you know, was a success of in your term. I'm wondering if you want to just talk about that a little bit, about lessons learned regarding the difference between a pilot program versus and the attention it might get even in the national media versus what matters on the ground to voters in a place like Stockton.
Yeah, well, I really struggle. I think it's a false dichotomy.
Okay.
I remember telling someone last week that if all I did was basic income for 125 people, then people should be upset. But that was one piece of a much larger, like, we were hitting on all cylinders, but I think so much of the attention was on the basic income pilot. But the idea was always to be you test something, you pilot it, but it would have to be at scale at the state in national level. I think the fact that a couple of years later we have money in the state budget, we have 60 mayors doing it, we have a federal guaranteed income policy called the Child Tax Credit points to the success and sort of the wisdom of that approach. But I would say,
can I just jump in here? And sorry, because you're right. It can be a false dichotomy, and I don't mean to actually pit one against the other. I in fact think the false dichotomy emerges because a lot of media attention comes you know, focuses on the pilot, right? So it becomes a bigger thing politically than what it actually is intended to be policy-wise, right? Like, a pilot is a pilot. You're totally right. You have to start small to work your way to big. But, like, didn't it kind of bite you in the back, though? Because with all that media attention, my understanding is that a lot of folks in Stockton were like, well, that had nothing to do with me.
Yeah, I think there was a backlash to the amount of media attention, for sure. But, I mean, we just received a lot of media attention for anything. Like, anything we did was, like... So I think the basic income was part of it, but people were upset at Forbes ranking me 30 under 30, or Fortune, before basic income, and Fortune magazine named me 40 under 40. I think people were... There was some resentment at how... It looked like sort of my future prospects were going to be brighter than the city's. I think there was some resentment to that. But I also think, and you mentioned this a lot in sort of the intro, whenever you're the first anything, it's not because you're the best of your kind or the smartest. It's because there's some institutionalized bias. So in context, you have sort of this... Oh, I hear the music. Okay, I'll wait till after the break.
Okay, good. I appreciate that. If only every guest would be so aware as you are, Michael Tubbs. We're speaking with Michael Tubbs. His new memoir is called The Deeper the Roots, A Memoir of Hope and Home. And we'll pick this up when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just want to give you a heads up that tomorrow we're going to be taking a look at the Infrastructure Act that President Biden signed this week. And we're going to be zooming in on a really interesting part of it that was kind of tucked into the Trillion Dollar Act. And that has to do with the Biden administration's views on nuclear power as a part of this nation's potential clean energy future. Now, the administration is propping up existing nuclear power plants because they provide half of this country's carbon neutral electricity. They're also backing, through the Infrastructure Bill Act now, development of a new generation of advanced and mostly smaller nuclear reactors. So we want to know what you think. Would you welcome a new generation of nuclear power as part of a clean energy mix in this country? Or are you concerned about nuclear and safety issues? Give us a call at 617-353-0683, 617-353-0683. That is for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking with Michael Tubbs. In 2016, he was elected as mayor of Stockton, California. He was 26 years old at the time, the city's first Black mayor. And we were talking about how being first at anything is oftentimes a double-edged sword. And we'll talk about that more in just a second. But he's joining us today because he's written his story in a new memoir called The Deeper the Roots, A Memoir of Hope and Home. And there's an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. So Michael, go ahead and pick up where you were leaving off about, that double-edged sword about being the first at anything.
Yeah, so when you're the first, you're going against sort of hundreds of years of a history of some sort of bias, some sort of ism, and you represent sort of a departure from that. So there's also an undercurrent of resentment and backlash there. I think, Stockton's not Oakland. It's not San Francisco. It's not the most sort of politically progressive place despite its diversity. So to have sort of the face of the city be this young Black mayor who wasn't parodying conservative talking points, who wasn't going to schools and telling kids to pull up their pants, but was having real conversation about structural racism, about sort of policies and about sort of equity, it just created a lot of angst and anger. I mean, we, in addition to basic income, I also ended the city's subsidy of golf courses, which didn't win a lot in France, but did save the city a lot of money. During COVID, I was the only one on my council who called for a mask ordinance. I was fighting with the county for resources. I was talking about the need to provide for our migrant workers. I was talking about how we need to build more affordable housing, how we can't just continue to demonize affordable housing when 50% of the city can't afford to pay rent. So I think it's all those things, plus the media attention, plus being a Black person, that create, and then a whole four-year disinformation campaign that created a perfect storm that led to me not winning re-election.
So let's talk about what you call a disinformation campaign. And a lot of that came from an organization called 209 Times, right, which describes itself as an independent grassroots news source for San Joaquin County, where Stockton is located. So, you know, and they were publishing, I guess, online a lot of stories about you, your policies, and their very critical take. Why do you call that a disinformation campaign?
It's a disinformation campaign because it wasn't true, right? Like the articles were literally lies. Like Michael Tubbs stole $60 million from homelessness, or Michael Tubbs is using taxpayer dollars to travel, or Michael Tubbs used taxpayer dollars to pay for his wedding. It was all sort of using the guise of being news and being grassroots news stories, but having a real sort of political agenda and really about sort of reverting back to a status quo where certain interests dominate city politics, where certain people got procurement projects, where certain people always had access to like the mayor and to governance. But I mean, it's not just me calling the disinformation site. I mean, NewsGuard, an independent news rating agency, said it's 17% trustworthy and called it a pink slime site. There's been numerous articles, investigative journalism pieces, et cetera, by people I don't know who have no relationship to me, who have pointed to this example of sort of disinformation in the way social media amplifies chaos by confusing people and presenting certain things as quote unquote news, when actually there's a very clear political agenda.
Well, I mean, yeah, they did post things like a terrible meme of you as a crack addict, right? I don't even like saying that out loud. And other other claims about that you're like you say, the scholarship program that you'd started in Stockton was quote missing millions of dollars, things like that. But you know, I wonder though if for example the person who founded 209 Times, Montecuzuma Sanchez. From what I understand, though, the two of you should have had a lot of common cause, right? I mean, Politico reported that Sanchez was raised by a single mother, and he described it as the exact same circumstances that, you know, you grew up in. But somehow his view of you and the possibility of the changes that you could bring to Stockton went south. I mean, do you understand why that might be?
I don't think, given the history of this country and sort of anti-Black racism, even sort of being like, even if our experiences were similar, he's never experienced anti-Black racism. Mm. And if he had, he wouldn't use it for nefarious political means. So I think sort of even that comparison isn't quite apples to apples. But I mean, it's not just about him. It's about who's funding the website. Where's the money coming from? Who's paying the $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 to build the audience? And who's funding that? And it's sort of right-wing conservative interests who are used to dominating San Joaquin County politics. Did they have a job? He needed to eat. So at that point, it's like, well, this is my way of being relevant. I may have some resentment or jealousy or whatever, because I'm 50 years old and haven't done as much as what this 28, 29-year-old has done. And here's an opportunity to kind of capitalize on the void created because there's a news desert, to prey on the fact that Stockton, my hometown, is the least educated city of the top 100 metro areas in this country, and really become relevant again. And because of that, now he has a six-figure job with the school district running parent engagement because the people are scared to get on his bad side because he has this disinformation website called 209 Times. But I don't think it's him. It's really about who's funding it and sort of how they came together. And I have to give them credit. It was very smart. It was like Cambridge Analytica at a very local level. Very smart in a sinister way. But in terms of the aim of, because it's not just me, like every person who was endorsed by the Democratic Party from state assembly on down lost in Stockton in 2020 when the exact opposite was true in 2016. Uh-huh. So it's a real sort of strategic move on behalf of kind of right-wing forces in California and nationally that paid off well, and they found their quote-unquote useful idiot to kind of be the face of it. So it doesn't look like it's racist. So it doesn't look like it's right-wing. But, I mean, the proof is in the pudding. The proof is in the impact, and the proof is in the funding.
Yeah, so I want to talk about both the specific and the systemic here in this situation that we're exploring. Because again, I'm referencing this as you know this long article about you in Politico, and in that article, Montezuma Sanchez, I think he's 45 now. He says that his view of you, dimmed actually back when you were on the city council. So this is the specific part. I mean, he points to that there was a controversy around a library in a poorer part of the city. And I mean, this is why like local is very local and people feel very strongly about it. And according to Politico, when you were on the city council, you'd opposed a plan to reopen that branch immediately because the city didn't have enough money. And Sanchez said that was a sign to him that you had actually forgotten about communities you were supposed to serve. Now, how do you respond to that?
It just like the article said, that the issue was we didn't have money. And then what the article didn't say is I led the tax measure that same year to create the funding so that that library was open when I was mayor. Yeah. Right? So I think it's you can find any reason to not like somebody, right? You can find any reason to be justified in doing nefarious things, and that happened to be a reason. But in terms of the reality and the facts, it really doesn't stand up because it wasn't an opposition to libraries. It was a difference in timing. Like, let's open it when we have money. And I think that's just responsible governance. I think as an elected official, that's what you have to do. You can't just jump when the mob says jump and spend money when the mob says spend money. You have to be able to kind of have your values, look at the situation and say, okay, we can't do this now, but I agree with this goal, so let me find an avenue to pay for it.
Yeah.
And let's raise revenue to pay for it. And then was able to do that. And if you go by that library now, it says Mayor Michael Tubbs. It was open when I was mayor. Yeah.
Well, so that's the specific. And again, you've also pointed to what you see as a sort of systemic problem that the 209 Times sort of anti-Tubbs campaign raises, because you were talking about anti-blackness. Well, Montezuma Sanchez, you know, in talking about race and the impact that his online grassroots journalism website, whatever you want to call it, had on you. Here's what he told NPR's Invisibilia podcast earlier this year.
Every time we would come out and criticize him with valid criticism, it was not like, hey, let's focus on his issue and explain why he's always out of town. 209 Times is just racist. That's why they don't like the first black mayor. That was always their defense, is to try to introduce identity politics as their defense.
So Michael Tubbs, this is something that is a national issue now about views of systemic racism and disagreement about when that is actually the force at play. So how would you respond to what Sanchez said there?
They were racist. Even that statement's false, right? But then number two, it's not me. I mean, you look at what works. There's a black mayor who you're saying without any evidence, because it's not true, is stealing money, which goes into some people's belief that black people are inherently criminal. Mm-hmm. Sadly, that is racist. You have a meme of the black mayor as a crackhead saying, you have any more of those crack dollars? Those tax dollars, excuse me. That meme is also inherently racist. You have a picture of the black mayor holding 240s of malt liquor and calling him Black Jesus. That is also inherently racist. It is what it is. And I think we also know how racism functions. If you operate in the office similar to everyone else who's operating the office from you, when you do it, it's different. So when I was raising money for the city, it wasn't seen as a good thing, but something to be suspicious. Like, who's he? He's paying his family. Like, it was always like, oh, he's traveling to other conferences with other mayors who are also elected in other local communities. But it's so abnormal when I do it. That's really the function of racism. It's to make what's normal for one group of people suspicious and different and something to be angry about for others. They didn't create racism. Like, they're not the cause of racism. But they preyed on racism for advertising revenue and for dollars, which is sort of what we see with the Republican Party nationally. This whole hoopla over the lie of critical race theory. It's the same playbook, just manifesting in different ways. Mm-hmm. And people get tired of talking about racism. Well, let's get tired of being racist. I get tired of experiencing racism. It's not fun for me. Like, I would rather not have to say that's racist, but if things are racist, the only ways to fix it and rectify it is to call it out for what it is. And white supremacy is insidious, but it's also ubiquitous in our society. And we have to be willing to call it out. We have to be willing to have challenging conversations. And we have to be willing to really interrogate and say, okay, well, how do you do it different? Like, what is a valid critique? Mm-hmm. And a valid critique is one that's objectively based off fact and based off performance, not based off sort of perception and dog whistles.
Yeah. Hear, hear. I'm all for facts. You won't find any disagreement on that point. Look, we've just got a couple of minutes left here. And you have lived already many lifetimes within one life. And I just wonder, all these experiences that you've had over the past 10 years, 5 years, can you tell us a little bit more about how you're taking that forward and what you're doing now? We've just got about a minute and a half left.
Thank you for the conversation. I have two children, a wife, this book, The Deeper the Roots, launching an initiative called In Poverty in California, really focused on eliminating poverty in the Golden State and providing an example for the nation that it can be done. I'm really interested in sort of storytelling, really interested in sort of the notion of increasing our opportunity for all people, and really interested in ensuring that the government works for everyone, because I think we have examples of the government working well for some people in this country historically and today. And I'm really driven to figure out how to extend that same benefit, that same privilege to all of us. So that's the work I'll be engaged in for the next couple of decades for sure.
Any chance that that work also might lead you to throw your hat into the political ring again?
I would never say never. If you had told me 10 years ago I was going to be mayor of Stockton, I would have said absolutely not. Why would I want to do that? So I've learned just to shut. If you had told me last year what I'd be doing, I would say I'll be mayor of Stockton. So I just learned just to not make any predictions for my future, but just to be open to opportunity and just to be excellent in the things I'm doing now. But in the next 50 years, maybe. Although I enjoyed my 8 years in public office, I'm also enjoying kind of not being in public office and the ability to be more candid and forthright with what I think I'm actually really enjoying.
Well, Michael Tubbs, the new memoir is The Deeper the Roots, a memoir of hope and home. And we have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you over the course of this hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.